The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Good morning. My talk this morning is going to be, as it states there, about pilgrimage. And first question I'd like to do is kind of introduce us to the kind of broad scope within this kind of milieu within which we're situated when we talk about pilgrimage as this kind of overarching global phenomenon. And the first question I would pose to you is, you know, besides being pilgrims, as we kind of, as I sort of laid out there in the title, what do these people have in common, right? We see people in different sort of actions here, and here are the places that they're all sort of associated with, right? So they're all going to a certain place, right? So the first one, obviously, on the left here, this is the Kaaba in Mecca. We have St. James Compostela in Spain, the Mahabodhi Temple in India, and, of course, Graceland in Memphis, Tennessee. So questions I'd like to ask to kind of frame our conversation today really center around kind of problematizing some of these notions that we've inherited with this term pilgrimage. We're surrounded by it in our popular culture today. We've got all kinds of examples. We've got National Geographic magazines, and this is a French magazine that's come out. It's a themed magazine that just came out a month ago. You know, and we're surrounded with images of pilgrimage, people going on these great travels and journeys to different places throughout the world. And so I think that this lecture is an opportunity to kind of, you know, try to begin to understand those, some of those issues. It is a very contemporary phenomenon still, even though the bulk of this lecture will be a historical discussion. I would like to situate it within a contemporary framework of because it's very relevant today. I mean, as this is from the National Geographic website, which was also published in a magazine a few months ago, which talks about global pilgrimage. Really, it tries to kind of elicit essentializes a lot of different pilgrimages around the world. And it highlights, and on their website, they actually have an interactive map where you can click and read all about the different types of pilgrimages around the world. And, you know, again, just to kind of remind us of the contemporariness, really, of the of pilgrimage, it does have over 300 million travelers per year are traveling on some kind of faith tourism or religious pilgrimage of some sort. And it is an $18 billion a year revenue in generating industry. So this is something that's extremely relevant. And so here's the National Geographic interactive map, and you can kind of click on all these different places and try to gain an understanding. And so we can understand pilgrimage as this, as, you know, occurring all over the world. But for our sake, for this lecture, I think it's very important to kind of hone in focus on some specific traditions. So today we're going to be looking at an example from Egypt, early Buddhism, Islam, and Christianity. But first I'd like to kind of problematize what pilgrimage is, what it means, what's going on here. The question is, what is a pilgrimage, right? So it's usually a journey of some sort. Somebody's traveling to some degree to see some sacred or some holy, either a relic or a space or something. And these people usually pay some kind of homage or respect, and they perform this journey out of some kind of sense of a duty or some kind of responsibility. There's something that kind of, you know, gets them to go on it. And what a pilgrim is not necessarily, you know, we're not really going to cover that specifically because that's more of a sort of an anthropological thing, but we are going to address a couple issues related to pilgrims because they are obviously very diverse and they're the reason that pilgrimages exist. So to some extent, we need to understand that what a pilgrim is and who they are, very basically. And I've tried to kind of outline or reduce some of the themes of pilgrimage to three kind of very basic kind of ideas. So there's the faith, obviously, which is involved. And this is not necessarily religious. It can be some kind of spiritual entity or personage, as I mentioned, can be religious or secular, as we saw with Elvis already. People can believe in something related to somebody. But most importantly, there's a desire to do something about it. And so that's where movement comes in. And so movement, we can basically understand it as this whether, you know, in some traditions we're going to talk about circumambulation, and some traditions we're going to talk about procession. But there's this constant thread of movement, which is kind of a thread within all of these different traditions. There's something's moving, right? Whether it's the sacred or the profane, or whether it's people or whether it's an object, things are constantly moving, which is obviously very important for us spatially. And of course, that brings me to the differentiation of space. And so space really is a key to this this understanding, understanding the differences in the conceptions of space between these different traditions, and how the different traditions understand this notion of the sacred and the profane, right? So we've kind of inherited this very dualistic diagram of the sacred versus the profane, right? They're always kind of like opposed to one another in our kind of traditional understanding. You're either sacred or profane. Spaces can be sacred or profane. And so what I would really like to do is challenge our understanding of that. And this is the sort of traditional path that a pilgrim takes, right? They move from the profane through or into the sacred, and then they come back to their profane existence, somehow transformed. So how does that transformation occur? Again, anthropology here does a little better of a job, and they sort of help me out with this understanding. The anthropologists have been studying this since like really the 60s. And so there's three quick stages of a pilgrimage journey that I'd like to kind of elicit here. And this is the preliminal, liminal, and post-liminal, right? So the anthropologists kind of liken this to a graduation ceremony, where the preliminal is the separation phase, right, where students are with their parents and are kind of milling about. And then they all kind of, they get their robes on, right? So they're differentiating themselves. Then they all go sit in the middle of the they are separated from their parents and families. They sit there. Then they're in this liminal phase, where there's this transitional phase where people give their, you know, lectures, and they talk about how great the class is and what happened that year and all those things. And so then this notion of communitas kind of evolves out of that, right? So there's this feeling of a community that they're together with people. And so very basically, the anthropologists talk about how there's this together feeling that they're doing something together. And then the post-liminal is the reincorporation into society. You've thus graduated, you've been given your degree, and now you're reincorporated into society as an individual. You're part of this community of people with a degree, right? So this is kind of, but I'd like us to keep in mind this notion of communitas as we move forward. The first kind of example here in slide 16 is we're going to look at a sort of an ancient example in the New Kingdom of in Egypt, the Karnak. And so this is very basically where it's located in Africa. And this is a procession. Basically, it's a very early form of pilgrimage, and really it takes on this notion of the procession to a very specific in a very specific manner. People aren't necessarily coming from extremely far distances to come to Thebes, this general area here that we can see, but there are people within Thebes that and this is a very unique procession in that. The notion of the sacred that we talked about just briefly earlier, the sacred is actually very interesting because it's co-located. There are the temples themselves are sacred and the spaces are sacred within them, but there's something very interesting here where the sacred is actually moved. So the gods actually leave the temples and are processed through these different areas. And we can see here from this first example. There's two main festivals I'd like to very briefly talk about. There's the OPET festival, which is essentially this route. All right, so very basically, Karnak Temple here, and then the procession. There's a couple of different ways in which this happens, but the earlier kingdoms example leaves from Karnak, takes the land route to Luxor, then goes in the Nile, and then comes back via the Nile. And so what's happening is the god Amun. He inhabits Karnak, right? So he's removed, his image is removed, and thus their understanding of the god. So they put him on a bark, which is the ship, and I'll show you that in a minute. But I'd like to first show you this is the Feast of the Valley. And this route this is a little bit later because it includes the Temple of Hatshepsut and the Medinet Habu over here. So this, again, and the arrows are double-headed because there's in different eras, the routes went different ways. Sometimes they went out on the water and came back on the water, and sometimes they went over the land. And so here it is, a kind of a plan view. Again, here you can see how there's multiple pathways here. But the key to our understanding is, and just a couple views here, this is of the ram-headed sphinx. So you can obviously get a sense of this very hieratic sort of processional space that was occurring. And so my kind of diagram here sort of tries to understand this notion of the sacred and the profane in this Karnak example. And so I would put forward that the sacred is not not only an object here, the little sacred, which is the image of the god or the god himself, but he's within the sacred temple complex, and he's literally processed through profane spaces to go visit his son, Khonsu, or his wife, Mut. So he's going to he's processed through these different temple complexes, and eventually he ends up back in another sacred space. So what happens is that the people in the procession actually pick up the bark. So this is an example here of the bark, and then the image of the godhead is inside, and thus the belief is that the god is there, he's present there. They've removed him from the inner sanctum of the temple, and he's processed through space. And so here, all the celebrations, people are bringing cattle with them, and here we can see people playing a lute-like object. So there's and this is an artist's rendering of a large bark on the river, on the Nile. And then within it, you can see the small bark with the image of the god, god within it. So, and it's very interesting. I'd like to just very quickly, briefly read. Herodotus saw one of these processions at one point, our friend, the Greek historian, and he describes it very interestingly. He says, "The Egyptians hold their solemn assemblies not once in the year, but often. Now, when they are coming to the city of Bubastis, they do as follows. They sail men and women together in a great multitude of each sex in every boat, and some of the men have rattles and rattle with them, while some of the men play the flute during the whole time of the voyage, and the rest, both men and women, sing and clap their hands. And when they sail, they come opposite to any city on the way, they bring the boat to land, and some of the women continue to do as I have said. Others cry aloud and jeer at the women in the city. Some dance and some stand up and pull up their garments. This they do by every city along the riverbank. And when they come to Bubastis, they hold festivals celebrating great sacrifices, and more wine of grapes is consumed upon that festival than during the whole rest of the year." So you can see here that these individuals in these reliefs that are out of the Luxor temple and the Karnak, these are just a variety of reliefs kind of showing, kind of outlining this processional activity. And these priests are called Wab priests. The next tradition that we're going to take a look at here differs to quite some extent, and this is Buddhism. Now, we've already talked about the Buddha and his origins and the kind of origins of Buddhism and the fact that it begins in India and it kind of spreads throughout Asia. And so we've covered that. But what I'd like to come back to now is this notion of pilgrimage with Buddhism. And As we've talked about before, we've talked about the Eightfold Path and what it means to, you know, enlightenment. We've discussed the ideas of the stupa and what those are, and the variety of traditions, obviously, here. This is an example from Thailand of a Buddhist procession. This is also an example of a Buddhist shrine in Myanmar. And this I just show this slide basically because there's this notion in Buddhism that I've come across of the kind of difficulty associated with the path warrants more. And there's like an accumulation of merit. There's this kind of the harder the path, the more of a struggle, the greater the attainment of some kind of spiritual or kind of merit, I guess, is for lack of a better term. But really, I'd like to point us to the scriptural basis and motivation within Buddhism. And here, the Buddha is believed to have said, called for the pilgrimage to four main sites. So he says here, the Tathagata, which is he's referring to himself, the perfected one. He says that the first is where he was born. The second is where he attained supreme enlightenment. The third is where he set in the wheel of Dharma, where he gave his first lecture. And then the fourth is where he passed away into Nirvana, where he died. And so these, to kind of illustrate some of the themes around Buddhist pilgrimage that sort of begin to define it, are that this early notion of Buddhist pilgrimage is based around the Buddha's life. So many people will travel to these different sacred places in the order in which they happened. Not necessarily from what I've come across, but it is sometimes, if somebody's going to do the entire route, they'll go to everyone in that order. And so you're sort of traveling in this path of the Buddha, of a holy individual. You're kind of recreating trying to re-experience their life, essentially. And there are relics within these different places. So the presence or the sacred throughout the land is sort of dispersed throughout the landscape. And circumambulation is a key feature to Buddhism. There's a lot of circumambulation as a kind of a spiritual, as a sort of spiritual reflection, and also the accumulation of merit for long and difficult journeys, which I've already briefly discussed. The four main locations are Lumbini, Sarnath, Bodh Gaya, and Kushnagar, which are the sites that we'll be looking at specifically. But before we get into that, again, I would like to come back to our notion of the sacred and the profane with each of these examples. And this is just another diagram, kind of trying to outline the way in which, one way at least, in which we can view an understanding of the sacred and profane in early Buddhist pilgrimage. And so here again, we have these kind of sacred nodes, and we passed through them, through the profane, to get to each one. And like I said earlier, there's not a specific manner in which that happens. But this becomes more complicated when Buddha's relics are distributed into over 80,000 places, and it becomes a little bit more complicated later. But for now, we're kind of trying to focus on the early aspects. The first, this is the birthplace of the Buddha in Lumbini, which is present-day Nepal. He was born in 563 approximately, and located in the foothills of the Himalayas. And what we see here on the left is an Ashokan pillar, which marks the birthplace of the Buddha. And you can see the monks and other pilgrims kind of circumambulating around it. And then on the right, we have a reflecting pool with a more recent temple. The second example is this is where the Buddha delivered his first meeting, where people come to pilgrimage. They also circumambulate this stupa. This is the Dharmak stupa, again, built by Ashoka in the 3rd century. So essentially, the great Emperor Ashoka came and sort of built all these monuments to commemorate the Buddha. And so The third place is one of the most holy. It's where he achieved enlightenment. Next, under the Bodhi tree, which is what this temple, the Bodhgaya, at Bodhgaya, the Mahabodhi temple, commemorates. This is a brick structure, and it is approximately 180 feet tall. And the brickwork depicts scenes from the life of the Buddha. And this is where he really is transformed from Prince Gautama to the Lord Buddha. So this is an extremely important location for pilgrims. This is a footprint sculpture of the Buddha's feet, and also a pilgrim inside commemorating the life of the Buddha. The last place is Kushinagar, which is where the Buddha passed away. On the bottom, we see a 6-meter-long statue that was excavated in the 19th century. The Buddha's remains were at one point deposited here under the Nirvana Stupa. Basically, this is where he performed his last sermon and subsequently passed away. So as we move forward, we're going to take a look at the tradition of Islam and pilgrimage, which I sort of argue here in my title is Consolidation and Globalization of Pilgrimage. And I say that because in Islam, no matter where you are, you're essentially required to go to Mecca to make the pilgrimage or the Hajj. And this obviously can entail quite a bit of travel. And so similar to Buddhism, Islam is scripturally based. It's in the Quran. It's also the fifth pillar of Islam, which requires all Muslims to go make the Hajj. And so here we just have a very basic, very quick slide to slide 38 to indicate, to show the significance of the Kaaba in Mecca. I'm going to get back to this in a minute here. But what's occurring is circumambulation. Again, we can see with the kind of long exposure photograph here of the movement around the Kaaba. And so my diagram is naturally one that is very, very much about congregating into one specific sacred holy place, right? So it's a very basic diagram that tries to just at least articulate this idea that we're all coming from these different profane spaces, but we all, when we come together in Mecca, this is the sacred. It's the moment of the sacred. And so just some very basic characteristics. I don't want to get into these too much, but circumambulation again. But one of the biggest things I'd like to discuss here is this notion of communitas again, which really the Hajj takes place once a year, and it is performed communally. So this is a very big aspect of it. I mean, it's not to say that you can't go on the Hajj the rest of the year, but it's still required that you make the Hajj as a communal thing, the official Hajj at once. And so this notion is kind of very important. It's very central to Islam. And so the three main locations, which obviously the most important is Mecca, which is the Al-Masjid Al-Haram, which is the sacred mosque, which is the Kaaba is located within that. The other two main sites for pilgrimage that are not required for Islam are Medina, where the house of the Prophet or the Mosque of the Prophet is located, and also in Jerusalem with the Dome of the Rock. This is just a brief, interesting map from the 10th century by the geographer Al-Jihani, who indicates to us, the viewer, how important Mecca is to Islam, how he literally is drawing it as the center of the world. And this is just a quick graphic I found that shows, again, it's interesting because my diagram sort of abstracts this in a way. This is literally the amount of percentage of people coming from different locations throughout the world coming to the Hajj in 1982. So it's just a kind of a quick graphic so you can easily see where the great number of Muslims are coming from. It would be interesting to see a more recent version of that, obviously, given the change in population locations. This is an abstracted plan of the mosque, the Al-Haram Mosque, and really up to the year 785. So it's a very basic mosque. The Kaaba is in the center, and it's beginning to acquire this kind of colonnade around it. And so by the 18th century, the Kaaba is here located centrally. You can see the colonnade is pretty well established around it, and the city is filling in pretty densely around it as well. And this is what it is basically contemporarily today, as it looks today. And so this is as it is today during the Hajj, full of pilgrims. Again, another view. And this is the Kiswa. This is the black silk cloth that covers it. This site is very sacred to Islam for a number of reasons, but basically, Ibrahim or Abraham is said to have left his wife and son Ismail here very briefly while he went to Palestine, and Ismail discovered, or you know, it's a long story, but he discovered a spring here, this holy well of Zamzam. And so not only is that significant, and then obviously, well, not obviously, but Allah instructed Ibrahim to build this structure to commemorate him. And so he did that, and this is also supposedly the tomb of Abraham as well. So there are all kinds of other significant associations with this. And so here, this is just a quickly show some pilgrims performing the Hajj, where they're coming from and where they're going. And this is obviously a very dense, packed street here because it's a highly ritualized reenactments and circumambulation. There's all kinds of interesting things going on here. Again, this is the village of tents at Mina, nearby Mecca. So these are all tents, and this space can essentially contain about 3 million pilgrims when they come to perform the Hajj. And then another quick interesting thing I found is these are all images of house paintings displaying evidence of having completed the Hajj. So like if you've completed the Hajj, you're a Haji, and you celebrate that by either a painting or, you know, at least in these kind of very localized examples. And so here's an image here on the left side of the Kaaba that this person has obviously completed the Hajj. And this is Burak, the horse that Muhammad rode into heaven. Very briefly, this is the Prophet's Mosque in Medina as it looks today. So again, it's full of pilgrims. People are coming here all throughout the year. Another central monument to Islam is the Dome of the Rock, which we're really not going to spend any time with, but I just wanted to show it very briefly. This commemorates several things as well. This is where supposedly that Muhammad rode the horse up into heaven, and also the point where it's thought that Abraham was instructed to kill his son Isaac, and then obviously the angel interceded and prevented that. So this is also and here's the rock. This is just a view of the rock from above. So that was kind of the whirlwind tour of Islam. It's obviously, you know, the struggle here is that there is so much culturally loaded in all of these examples and so much of a massive history associated with them that it's been very difficult to kind of reduce the amount of material. But that brings me to some Christian examples. And this is really some medieval. My main focus here in this presentation is the medieval period in Christianity. And this is just on the left, a drawing from the 15th century of a pilgrim on his way. And on the right, it's a drawing by Matthew Paris. It's a sort of a map of a pilgrimage route that he performed in 1250 that is interesting because it highlights that he actually articulated, he drew all the buildings that were along the way that he, you know, all the different buildings that he visited along the way of his pilgrimage route, which I found was very interesting and appropriate. The main center or the focus of the medieval Christian pilgrimage was to St. James of Compostela, which is located out here in the Iberian Peninsula. And you can see here on this map, Paris, Vézelay, Le Puy, and Arles. Those are the kind of main centers of where the pilgrimage would start, and people would progress down these pilgrimage routes along and hitting different holy places along as they go. This is a reconstruction of Santiago de Compostela, and as it would have looked in around 1100, it's pretty interesting. It was developed by some students and faculty at UCLA in the architecture department. I'm not sure how authentic it would be, but it's a lot better than the Baroque afterthought, which is what we have right now. The Romanesque structure has been completely covered with a Baroque structure. So this is, again, we come back to our sacred and profane diagram. And this is sort of how I envision the movement from a sacred space through the profane to, essentially, there's this very linear movement to an ultimate sacred place. That's, you know, there's some hierarchy here. One is processing, essentially metaphorically, through this landscape of the profane and reaches these different sacred spaces to which they can, benefit by grace of some sort. We can't talk about this without discussing this just massive proliferation of architecture that just was generated around this time. And so this is just four examples out of the book that show us the four examples of pilgrimage churches. And you can see right away the cruciform similarity that they share, the larger apses, these apsidioles, which where relics would either be located within the apse here or within these apsidioles. And so pilgrims would be able to come in and sometimes they would circumambulate here or they would process in and out. And very specifically here, we have an example from Saint-Foix in Conques in France around 1120. And this is interesting because the beginning of the story is there was a monk who translated or stole some relics from one place in another location in France, brought them here. Essentially, everybody followed, and they created this large church to kind of celebrate the relics of Saint-Foix, Saint Faith, who was a martyr from the 3rd century. And here's her rendered image, and I just wanted to quickly read this by a clergyman named Bremard d'Angers. From 1010, he's talking about this relic. He says, when they saw it for the first time, all in gold and sparkling with precious stones and looking like a human face, the majority of the peasants thought that the statue was really looking at them and answering their prayers with her eyes. So there's a great deal of interest around these relics, the reliquaries, and the kind of sacredness of these spaces. This is Saint-Foix, more views. We can't forget that one of the most important pilgrimages in the medieval period was one that is obviously as mixed, not so mixed, it's pretty rather controversial pilgrimage, but that is the everyone's familiar with the Crusades, which essentially occurred between around here, the dates that I've sort of shown. And the thing I wanted to kind of elicit out of the Crusades was this notion of exchange of architectural techniques, right? So one thing I just want to quickly discuss here is this notion. Obviously, the Crusades went to the Holy Lands, what they believe were the Holy Lands, which were obviously Jerusalem and Bethlehem and all these places along associated with the life of Christ. What I'm showing here, depicting, is the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, which is using the pointed arch, right? So very basically, the Crusaders bring back some of this technology, that pre-existed in Islam for many years before. The Crusaders bring it back, and we see a quick, steady development of different types of arch systems, from the barrel, the Roman kind of groin vaults. And of course, the importance here is there's this relationship between how high you go and how wide you are, right? That's a fixed point of relationship. But once you introduce the pointed arch, that anything's fair, right? So that brings me to the example of Saint-Denis, which is another pilgrimage church. This is an image. This is a stained glass image of Saint-Denis. And so this is the plan. And so we can see here in this apse the big additions that Abbot Suger went through. And I wanted to just quickly read this.
Video removed due to copyright restrictions.
So he goes on to explain how horrendous the conditions were in viewing these relics. So he totally expands the church, and you get this amazing network of vaulting going on here that's brought about essentially by this newer technology of the pointed arch. And I just really wanted to quickly, briefly go through some more recent or contemporary things. The Santiago de Compostela is still a pilgrimage route that is still practiced today. These are all very contemporary people performing this. This is a sign in France that indicates it's 953 kilometers because people are still taking these pilgrimage routes. And then in Lourdes, in France, I wanted to just highlight the story of Bernadette Soubrieux, who in 1858 saw a sighting of the Virgin Mary in this nowhere village that didn't even have a railroad station or anything. It was extremely difficult to get there, and she was an uneducated, illiterate peasant girl, essentially, so to speak, who saw this vision and turned this place, essentially, her vision turned it into this this key central Christian pilgrimage location. And here you can see on the bottom right a very contemporary view of pilgrims coming here again. And then Bernadette dies, and they turn her into a relic, essentially. So it's sort of, it's very interesting, this whole process that's occurring. And again, in later Christianity, it's interesting because we almost come back in a full circle back to Karnak, there's an understanding of the movement or the procession of the sacred. The sacred actually is moved from one location to another. And on the left, we have an example of in Poland, on the upper right in Italy, and then on the bottom right, we have the famous Semana Santa in Spain, the Holy Week ceremony, where you have quite an amazing amount of proliferation of processions. And more recently, we also have more Christian processions with pilgrimages to see all kinds of things, right? Rome, this whole space is all about procession and pilgrimage. And if you ever want to go to any of these places, you can hop online and click if you're Protestant, my interest is Protestant or whatever. And then if you're Buddhist, you can find Buddhist pilgrimages to go to Lumbini, Bodh Gaya, wherever. The Hajj, of course, is, you know, not a problem at all. They can do that for you. There's packages, trips from JFK. You can even rent a pilgrim, which is a medieval notion, the peregrinatio pecuniae causa, which is where you would pay a pilgrim to go in your stead. And this notion you can do. It's interesting. I only raise this issue because it's interesting because it's connected to architecture in a very interesting way. So if you do go onto this website and rent a pilgrim, this guy will walk for you, and you'll pay him, and he'll do the walk. And the money will go to fund the renovation of the city church, St. Jacob in Rottenburg in Germany. And so it's very interesting. And then, of course, you get a emblem that you went on the pilgrimage, right? Your scallop pendant. And there are all kinds of contemporary guides to St. James. This is an image of the Buddhists doing the Santiago de Compostela. So there's this kind of very interesting global thing going on here. You know, just this notion of a sacred space, following the path of a sacred, no matter what kind of denomination or whatever it is. Secular pilgrimages, not the focus necessarily of the talk, but still an important aspect to popular culture that we're surrounded with today, JFK and Vietnam Memorial. And, of course, Elvis, we can't leave Graceland out with his tomb here. And there's just, if the closer you look, there's just these very odd stories about people This is a former military installation in the desert that people flock to every year and do these interesting sculptures. But basically, I think it's important to think about the contemporary pilgrimage and how it relates to our historical examples that we just discussed, and how it's continually readapted and interpreted through different world cultures and traditions.